Hello, welcome to Pints with Treebeard. My name is Josh Edgren. I'm a pastor and teacher in Moscow, Idaho, and I have the honor, the joy, the pleasure, the delight of being joined by the Master and Commander, Jameson Winter. Jameson, will you tell us about yourself, sir?
I will, and I feel like all of your introductions for me are always so flattering. I just kind of throw it to you with no pomp or circumstance. But yes, I'm Jameson Winter. I'm the dean of the upper school at Augustine School here in Jackson, Tennessee. And I have the pleasure of teaching things like Euclid and The Lord of the Rings to my students. So, Josh, today we're not talking about either of those things. What is it that we are discussing?
So a little while ago, we did kind of a big, broad overview of stories. We talked about the importance of reading to your kids. We looked at a bunch of examples of particularly picture books to give to your younger children. Every now and again, though, on the show, we'd like to devote a whole episode to a particular story or even a particular piece of cinema, or ideally both. And so that's what we're doing today. We're looking at the story of Robin Hood in all of its various forms. And of course, like a lot of the great stories, there's not one canonical version of Robin Hood necessarily. So it's depicted a bunch of different ways in children's books, movies, et cetera, et cetera. So we're not attending to any particular rendition, more the conglomerate, the whole. But the goal today is to look at the story and see where it fits or where it can fit in family life, why it's particularly potent for your boys, what lessons it brings out for them, how it serves them. So that's kind of the topic of the day, Robin Hood, why it's awesome. So where do you want to go first, Jameson? What do you think?
Well, I want to mention what you initially wrote. This would have been months ago in the description for this episode idea, which is that your description of what we would talk about is if you had only one story to give your boys, why it should probably be Robin Hood, and why the Disney animated Robin Hood is perhaps the height of cinema. You also mentioned the notable glories of the Errol Flynn version, which I have yet to watch. I was trying to watch it before we did the episode, but I didn't get there. And so that is on the list. We're looking to make that a family movie night very soon. But I will say my familiarity with Robin Hood primarily comes from the Disney version, although I did listen to my dad reading some version. I don't know which, because, you know, there are probably five dozen or so. Some version of the Robin Hood stories growing up, and we are working through the Robin Hood, whichever the version is on canon right now. We're listening to that with the boys in the car.
Yeah, Howard Pyle, maybe. I forget.
So that's been great because it's introducing them to more characters with greater depth, and they see the complexity in the story. I think that one of the chief virtues of Robin Hood, as you kind of alluded to there, was just that this gives our boys a role model to follow in so many ways. This is an inherently masculine story, not to the point that it's not enjoyed by girls, but it's clearly got a lot to speak specifically to young boys and how they should act and live in the world and what they should aspire to be like and what they should aspire to maybe curtail within themselves so that they don't become the tyrants and the wicked characters of the story. So what are some of the things that stand out to you in Robin Hood in terms of the virtues that it kind of puts front and center for our boys to imitate?
Well, okay, so from the very beginning, almost all the versions of Robin Hood have his fall from grace in some respects. So the whole setup is always that he's an outlaw, that he's an outcast, that he is, but not because he was wicked, but because he's been unjustly persecuted. So you have this whole, like, what do you do when the world's all against you? So the various versions deal with it different ways. I actually really like the Errol Flynn version because it shows him being the target of oppression from the Normans because he's standing up for his Saxon brothers. And so you have this, like, he's driven out from his lands. He loses everything. He loses nobility because of his charity, because of his defending the weak. So the whole setup of the story is, what do you do when the world's out to get you? Which is just a great posture that you want your boys to have a category for. Like, what do I do when everything's against me? But then the beautiful thing is, what does he do? He gathers a bunch of merry men, and he just has a ball of a time. And he has this joviality, which I think the Disney animated version captures beautifully. There's this lightness, there's this delight, there's this courage, this masculine, devil may care, swashbuckling attitude that I argue is essential to our understanding of the character of God. Like, there's this joviality in God that his people ought to emulate. So what do you do when the world's against you? You go and you gather your buddies in the woods, and you laugh and you sing, and you seek to live righteously.
It's interesting to use that word jovial. I think it's so true, and of course of the Disney version, but even of the others. I mean, I think of the one that we're listening to right now with the boys. You know, when Robin and Little John meet, in most of the versions of the story, if you see their meeting, it's a combat. Like, they're fighting each other with sticks, typically on a bridge over a river, and Robin gets knocked into the water after, in the version that we're listening to, an hour of fighting each other with sticks on a footbridge. And they'd just been hitting each other in the ribs, like whacking each other as hard as they could. And he falls down into the water, and they, you know, they get out of the river, and they respect each other because of how they fought, and they laugh it off, and they become fast friends. And in fact, Little John was looking for Robin Hood and his merry men to join the outlaws. And so, you know, you see this kind of joviality even in those moments where it's seeming conflict, and yet, at least amongst the good guys, it's a conflict that is kind of self-aware and understands we're not fighting to the death here, right? We're fighting for honor. We're fighting for prestige. We're fighting for a place in kind of this motley crew, so to speak, but we're not fighting over life and death. That is for our enemies, right? We're fighting our enemies for life and death. We're kind of trying to be the protectors. And that's just great. I think one thing that stands out to me about, you know, the story and how it changes if you don't have the joviality is, have you seen the Russell Crowe version?
No, I haven't.
Yeah, you didn't miss much.
That's what I heard.
It's like they tried to turn Robin Hood into Gladiator, which just doesn't work. It was very self-serious, and it was all about fighting in a war and not about Robin Hood being a merry man and, you know, robbing the rich to feed the poor and all of these things. I only saw it once, I think in high school. But yeah, it was missing some key elements, and I never knew what all of those elements were, other than just that they don't tell a lot of the story. But I think one of the major ones is it has no kind of joviality or comedic undertones, and it's taking itself way too seriously.
Yeah. You mentioned the meeting with Little John. Also, in sort of a lot of the classic renditions, his meeting with Friar Tuck is very similar. And this is often portrayed wonderfully. So Robin's is the master. He's the leader of the band. He's the greatest of archers. But importantly, in both the meetings with Little John and Friar Tuck, he's bested to some degree, and then is able to laugh it off. And he loses no respect. He loses no dignity by having his own dignity taken lightly. And I think that also is something that you want your boys to get a sense of. Like, I need to be able to laugh at myself. And Robin's always laughing at other people. And then when the joke is turned on him, he laughs at himself. And there's that free and easy humility that is so essential.
And in the version that we're listening to, when he meets Will Stutley, it's actually both of them in disguise at the archery tournament. And they're going back and forth after all of the others have fallen out of contention at this point. And again, he's almost bested, if I remember correctly. So he hits dead center, and Will Stutley's arrow, something happens. I can't remember exactly what, but something happens where his arrow kind of glances Robin's. It's not the arrow split that everybody knows Robin Hood is famous for, but the way it's portrayed is essentially, okay, any other time he takes that shot, it's splitting Robin's arrow down the middle, and some extenuating circumstance, I can't remember what, stops it from happening. And so Robin is like, yeah, I mean, I'll keep going if you want. Like, we can keep shooting some other time. I know they gave me the golden arrow, but he's recognizing something it kind of prevented Will Stutley from being able to compete at his full capacity. And he wants to go back into the competition and see Will's best and kind of see who's the better shot in the end. And that's the idea. He's not like looking to get out of the competition and win no matter the cost. And now I beat you, so I don't have anything to prove anymore. He wants to be pushed by others around him. Like you said, he doesn't take his own dignity too seriously. And he does recognize the dignity in others, right? He recognizes
yes.
the great ability of Will Stutley, who, by the way, is doing this with an eye patch on. So he's only looking with one eye. And anyway, it's a wonderful kind of changing of the Robin Hood story that I grew up watching, which is the Disney version, where it's just Robin and it's the context is slightly different. There's still the Golden Arrow and Maid Marian, of course, but yeah, that was a fun twist.
So again, zooming out a little bit, the framework of the Robin Hood story is, you know, what does a good man do when the world's against him? But why is the world against him? The world's against him because King Richard's gone, right? So you have like this whole setup is persevering until the king comes back. And living faithfully until the good king returns. And when the good king returns, all will be right. And that's the whole setup of the story. So you have not only Robin, what do you do when the world's against you, but what do you do when the world's against you in a particular way, namely that injustice is being done by those in power, and we have to stay true and loyal to the good king while he's away. But there's this hope that we're looking forward to. When Richard returns, then all will be well.
And it's not just that they have to stay true to the good king while he's away until he comes back. They also have to stay true to the people. Because you mentioned that Robin Hood is a noble, which you wouldn't know if you've only seen the Disney version. He's a noble, and he loses his nobility as an outlaw. And so he recognizes in the true story, if you're going into one of the longer versions, he recognizes a responsibility he has to the people because he is of the noble class, which means he's a protector and caretaker of the people. He's a steward of the nation and needs to act accordingly, even if he's been outcast. So it's not just the world is against him. The world is against him and has removed his ability to be the protector and the caretaker that he's supposed to be. And yet he doesn't give up on the mission. He continues the mission by whatever means necessary. And I think that's so lovely and also very important, maybe because people will say, well, what about this whole robbing the rich to feed the poor thing? What's
yes.
the deal there? And part of the point of the bigger narrative of Robin Hood is that he is not directly a magistrate, but in some sense serving the purpose of a lesser magistrate, pushing back against the unjust oppression. He's restoring order and has some real measure of authority by birth to do it.
And in these times when government overreach is not an academic subject, it's...
I can't possibly think of what you might mean.
Was it too subtle of an illusion? Okay, sorry. In these times, I think more than maybe in past times, maybe very recent past times anyways, we need our boys to understand that sort of distinction. Like, okay, Robin Hood robbed from that caravan. He took the gold. Was that good or was that bad? The story is telling me that it's good. Is that true? And if so, why? What does it mean? What's going on? And, oh, actually, it's the government that's doing the bad stuff. And Robin, although he is outside of the government, is actually doing the right thing. Okay, interesting. So these are subtle things. Complicated things that we need to have our boys work through. What's good and what's bad and why?
And another detail that you're missing if you've only seen the Disney movie is that there are principles here even to assessing who they steal from, right? They're not stealing from
yeah.
all of the rich, because you could get the idea if you just watch the movie or you've heard a little bit about Robin Hood, well, he thinks all rich people are wicked, but I know that's not true. Like, that's not right. That's not what
right.
I want to teach my kids. But it's implicit in the movie, but explicit in many of the books and stories that have been written, that he steals from the rich who are walking in injustice. He steals
yes.
from the rich who are wicked and gives back to the poor that which they had at one point often, but that which they no longer have because it's been stolen from them wrongly. And that's an important principle to push with this narrative so that the wires don't get crossed for our boys, so that they don't think, oh, well, so-and-so is richer than me. I can take his lunchbox. And like, now I'm Robin Hood, stealing from the rich, giving to the poor, me or my friend or whatever. We don't want that for our boys. They're actually becoming wicked if they walk that way. But to see he's pushing back against the wickedness and the tyranny explicitly is helpful for them.
That's exactly right. And walking through that with them. Okay. You know, what is justice in this unjust situation? It's a wonderful example of friendship, too. And I think you see that with a lot of the different renditions. You know, the friendship between Robin and Little John is wonderful. And that's well depicted in the animated version. Thoughts on friendship as depicted in Robin Hood.
Well, that's another reason that it stands out so clearly for our boys is because of the fraternity of the Merry Men. The idea that men gravitate towards these tight communities that have the same mission. And that's important. That's distinct, maybe in some ways, from how women gather and for what reason women gather. It's not a one-to-one. And you can, if you're interested in that, go listen to some women talk about that in another podcast. I don't know all of, you know, the intricacies there, but I do know that it is distinct because when men form fraternities, if they're healthy, it is because they share a common mission. That's not the only thing that they need. They could share a bad mission, but they share a common mission. They're pursuing virtue together in the pursuit of that mission. And it is a mission that is for the good of society in some respect, whether that's literally we're trying to help the poor people who are starving in Nottingham Town or whatever, or that's the betterment of some institution of learning or something like that. You know, you have these groups of men throughout history in various ways that we need as men to participate in so that we can grow and stretch and push one another.
And that's the sort of thing that we want our boys to be looking out for. We want our boys to be surrounded by like-minded brothers. We want our boys to be thinking in terms of who's my band, what's my mission, and giving them those categories through narrative is just great. And like we talked about before, there's a wonderful balance between Robin's mastery. Like, he is excellent. He is undisputably the master of the band, but he does not hold his dignity higher than he ought to. And he's willing to suffer. He's willing to put himself in harm's way for the good of the others.
It's the Three Musketeers, right? All for one, one for all. It's that idea. And we can talk about that story sometime too. But Robin recognizes that simply being the leader of the group, being the master, does not change his obligation to the members in the group. I mean, in some sense it does. It gives him a greater responsibility, but it doesn't allow him to skirt his obligation to lay down his life or to get in the way and prevent harm from coming to another by taking that harm on himself, right? He's always quick to do everything that he can to protect the group. He's not out for himself. And interestingly, I had not encountered this, at least not in my memory, where he goes to the sheriff's house and is part of the baker's guild or whatever that's gathering there, and he sees Little John there, and suddenly he didn't know that Little John was going to be here in disguise. He's questioning, why is he here? But then immediately he says, I know if he's here, he must be here for some good purpose. And so there's also in a fraternity that sense of trust and belonging and relying on each other. And obviously that trust can actually be betrayed. That's a real story too that could be told. But you see in Robin Hood this idea that I trust my men even when I don't always understand what they're doing.
Then, okay, pivoting to how does Robin relate to, or how is he a foil to the bad guys in the story? And this is also wonderful. And I think you see this in a bunch of different renditions. So who are the bad guys? Traditionally, you have Prince John, right? You have the Sheriff of Nottingham. In some versions, you also have Guy of Gisborne, who's this more personal rival to Robin. They would have been more equals in standing, and so they have a more personal animosity. In some versions, Guy is the one who's given Robin's lands, and so there's this, like, and he's also a rival for Marion as well. So you have this this varied cast of bad guys. And in the Errol Flynn film, but also in the animated one, Prince John is a pansy, right? He's a mincing. He doesn't have that masculine courage or strength or even bravado, you know, and that's done in the animated version one way. In the Errol Flynn version, he's this, you know, wearing gloves and speaking kind of like this. And, oh yes, and it's great. But he's the powerful one, right? He's the one. He's the king, or he's the ruler. But he's personally very weak, and so that contrast is potent. And then you have usually the blustering sheriff, who's cruel, vindictive, and maybe has some potency to him. In the animated version, I think they combine Guy and the sheriff, so he does have that personal animosity and that potency. But in other versions, the sheriff is more the blustering, blundering bravado, which is, again, not what you want your boys to be. And then Guy, traditionally, has potency. Like, he's actually, he's someone to be bested in a fight. The others, not so much. There's no glory in, there'd be no glory in beating Prince John in a fight.
Right.
Right. And in, there's no glory in beating the blustering sheriff in a fight. But there's glory in beating Guy, because he actually is a rival. And those are, I think, three just examples of masculinity gone bad, right? There's the ones who have no honor, no nobility in themselves, but are in power, and they need to be opposed. Then there's the bluster, the bravado, and the Errol Flynn version is great. The sheriff is always making excuses, and he's fat, and it's funny, and he's always being revealed as a coward. And then Guy is just wicked and cruel, and needs to be beaten head on. And compared to all of them, you have Robin. And Robin is noble, courageous, masculine, clearly a leader of men, clearly potent, competent, but not cruel. And so there's the best scene in the Errol Flynn version is this big feast in Nottingham, and it's all the Norman nobles going, ha 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 ha, we're so powerful, what are we going to do to these nasty little peasants? And then Robin comes in. And of course, what's Robin in trouble for throughout the narrative? Like, hunting the king's deer. And so what does Robin do? He comes in with this buck over his shoulders, and he just swaggers in and throws the buck down on the table. And all of them are just confused, shocked, but they decide to humor him. And Prince John just thinks it's hilarious, because of course he's going to squish him like a bug. And so he says, you know, pull up a chair, and, you know, so you count so-and-so, move over for this fellow. And Robin sits down and puts his feet on the table and starts going to town. And just bold as brass, you know, defying this tyranny. And then eventually, you know, Prince John gives the order for, you know, the bad guys to come stab him in the back. And of course, Robin gets out and then battles them all in this glorious feasting hall fight, and then escapes. And it's just this wonderful example of the contrast to all of them. And yet his personal courage is on display, but also, you know, you point out to your boys, divine providence is, like, there's no way that he defeats all of them. Like, unless God helps him, unless God's writing the story and God says, Robin doesn't die here, he gets out.
That's so good to think about the different kinds of masculinity gone wrong, because you've got, like you said, Prince John, who's just effeminate. He's not a man in any sense of the word. You've got the facade of a man, the man who's pretending to be masculine in the sheriff. And then you've got a real man, a real rival, someone who is masculine, who has, as you said, potency, and who has the ability to affect the world around him. And yet he's just corrupted. He's just wicked. And those are good examples for our boys also to think, this is what you're becoming when you act in this way.
Yeah.
And so don't act this way, because you're acting like Prince John right now. You're acting like the sheriff. you know, you want to be able to give them not just the thing to aspire to, but the warning of this is the path you're headed down. And don't do that, right? I love the way that Disney treats Prince John, because he's just the butt of the joke the whole time, which is what he should be. And there's a way to teach your kids maybe decorum in treating a wicked king with some measure of respect and honor as your ruler. This isn't maybe the story for that. You can teach them that in other ways.
Right.
But watching the people point out his faults, point out his whininess and sucking his thumb and calling for his mom. Mm-hmm. And like, it's something that our boys do, right? When they play Robin Hood, they bring that part into it. It's notable to them that Prince John is a whiny crybaby and he fusses all the time. And they recognize that's wrong. He's not a good king. And we're going to fight him, and we're going to, you know, take the money back that he's taken from the people. And we're going to celebrate when King Richard comes back. So yeah, it's just a rich kind of dynamic of good. And I guess I was going to say good and bad masculinity, but really what I mean is good masculinity and then masculinity coming up short, because all masculinity is good. It is by nature a virtue. And so when it's corrupted, what does that corruption look like? Well, we have many characters for that. One other aspect that I wanted to maybe think about with you is this kind of relation between Robin and Marian and winning the damsel, and thinking through how Robin Hood portrays marriage, and obviously the nature of a comedy ending in a wedding, and any aspects going into that. So what are your thoughts there?
Yeah, well, I just love that that's a part of the story, for one thing, that it has all these different elements, but it also has the get the girl element. But the girl is not the quest in this one. But she's also connected to the quest. Like, she is needing to be saved in some senses. You know, depending on which version you read, she's promised to you know, in marriage to Gisburn, and so she's got to be saved from that monster in that sense. But also there's an element in which, in some versions, she's converted to understanding what Robin's mission is, and she's not his mission, but she can be a help to it. And there's wonderful elements throughout that I think are good for our boys to have. So it is good and right for them to save the damsel. It's good and right for them to desire to marry, and that is, even on a little boy's level, it's right and good for them to be thinking of this as an honorable thing. One of the things I do love about the animated version is you have the romance aspect depicted on Robin Hood's level, but also on the children's level, and it's both. And I just think that's actually an extremely elegant touch. How do the little rabbit children perceive the romance aspect? Oh, they're kissing. That's sissy stuff, you know? And that's right and good for a little boy to think. And also, there's the upper level going on as well, which is he's going to win the girl. They're going to get married. They're going to have kids. Like, that's what's going to happen. So you see Robin's pursuit of Marian, and oh, you've got, again, just the lines alone, you know, faint hearts never won fair ladies. Like, if you've got that alone, you've learned a lot about how to get yourself a wife.
I want to come back to this, but I was just looking at a text that I got from Megan, and she said this. So I made Levi a bow out of an oak stave for his birthday.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I had some a lot of lumber lying around, so I made a bow and put some work into it to try to make it like a real bow with an arrow rest and everything, and not amazing job, but it's, you know, it's fun for a kid, and made some arrows with, you know, foam golf balls to shoot. And she sent me this text and said, Ezra on his own came up with the idea to try to shoot two arrows at once successfully, and now he's trying as many as he can line up on the string.
Yes.
So as we talk about Robin Hood, I've got an archer in training apparently at home, which is wonderful.
Several, it seems. Yeah,
that's right.
That's good.
So that line that you mentioned is my favorite line from the movie, "Faint heart never won fair lady." And that, more than anything, is what I want my boys to take away from Robin Hood, and to take away from many stories for that matter. It's something that I want them to embody and to understand, is that to enter into marriage with a good woman demands that you are a good man. It demands that you're a courageous man, and that you have a good understanding of your own capacities, and not an arrogant understanding, but a true understanding. And yet you're not this kind of self-deprecating, low confidence wimp, right? You're willing to go and to work and to take risk and to do what is good and right because it's good and right. And you're not concerned in some sense with failure, because you recognize that even in failure, if you've acted nobly, you have won, right? So you're not faint heart in that way. You're not shirking back from challenges and difficulties in life, because look, no self-respecting, virtuous woman wants to marry somebody who's going to back down from a challenge.
Yeah.
And I don't mean back down like somebody comes up next to you at the stoplight and revs his engine and you look at him and just kind of scoff and blow it off. But back down like you're under pressure here and I don't know if you're going to stand firm or not. And that can be in any avenue of life. That could be at work. That could be at church. That could be, you know, fighting sin in your own home. That could be big things, little things. If you don't have some fortitude, you're not going to win a fair lady. You're not going to find a good wife, because she's not going to be interested in you. And good for her, right? She doesn't want to be interested in you. She shouldn't be. And, you know, I'm not going to use that as a primary motivator for a five-year-old saying like, well, son, marriage, you know, you got to be thinking about your prospects. But you do want, like you said, you do want to show them, yeah, this is something for the future. And you want to become a good man so that in the future, that's a possibility. So it's not maybe the primary thing, but it is a good thing to kind of cast a vision for them.
I think that piggybacking off of that, the whole sequence in the Disney Robin Hood, where he goes to the archery contest just because there's a chance of him getting a kiss from Marian, and everyone tells him, like, this is ludicrous, this is a trap. And he says, I know, basically, but we're going for it anyways. Like, on the one hand, that's silly, maybe. But on the other hand, no, it's not. And that's the essence of what it takes to pursue a good woman, to pursue a wife. You have to have this devil may care. I know I'm totally exposing myself to danger here, but you know, she's worth it. That's the spirit that he's got to have. And I think that that's actually portrayed beautifully in that whole sequence. But then, conversely, this is also a story for girls. And I think Marian is a wonderful example of courageous femininity throughout the story, and I think in almost all the versions, that she's not just waiting to be saved; she is actively participating in the story, but in ways that are appropriate. It's portrayed in humorous fashion in the Disney version, but you know, throwing the pies at the guy who's at the vulture who's about to shoot it, right? And them talking about their honeymoon and their future plans while he's fighting his way, you know, fighting their way out. And she's cool as a cucumber because she's with him. And you know, that's that her trust in him, her willingness to accept the life that he's been called to, which is this outlaw life, is just beautiful. And then it's the scenes that follow are very, very sweet, and again giving this picture of romance, but then also, and I love it, they're interrupted by this boisterous celebration, and that's also how life is too, and then they're swept up into this communal thing, this communal rejoicing, which is what a wedding is, and then it all ends with a wedding, and that's right and good. So I think that it succeeds at portraying godly masculinity in the pursuit of a wife. I think it succeeds in that.
Yeah, I mean, even the idea of taking on danger to pursue this wife. I mean, look at Christ, the picture of the marriage of history between the God-man and his bride.
That's right.
He came to take on danger, right? And that's the story. That is what marriage is meant to be. And so, yeah, I agree that the scene there where he's actually even not interested in going to the archery tournament until he hears that she's going to give a kiss to the winner. He understands, I'm not invited. They're not going to want me there. And, you know, Friar Tuck pushes him a little bit. Man, Friar Tuck's a great character too. I would be loath if we didn't at least mention him.
Oh, yes.
In particularly the Disney version is I'm most familiar with Friar Tuck in that version of the story. But man, his showdown with the sheriff is one of my boys' favorite parts. Like, they'll do the whole belly bump thing to an invisible sheriff with their sword and swing a cane around.
Yep.
And say, I've got a quarterstaff, and, you know, swing it around and say, get out of my church. Mm. And man, it's wonderful. It reminds me of that scene from The Patriot where they're coming to the town and looking for volunteers to come and join not the Continental Army, but Benjamin Martin's crew. And they, who is it? It's his son's soon-to-be wife, right, who looks at their pastor, I think, and says, Reverend? And he just looks at her and says, you know, the shepherd has to tend to his sheep, and at times he has to fight off the wolves.
Yeah.
He and Friar Tuck are cut from the same cloth in that regard, and it gives you a good picture, again, of the masculine, which is these men who are called to bring the word of God to their people recognize that it's not the word of God alone, right? Without physical providence, without physical caretaking and ministering to the people in need, and even literally laying down your life for your flock if needed, which is just a beautiful and rich and true narrative that, again, I want my boys to see.
You know, Friar Tuck as a churchman, again, in all the different versions, the hearty enjoyment of the good gifts of God, the rough and ready, if Robin Hood's an outlaw, Friar Tuck is an ecclesiastical outlaw. But sometimes that's what's needed. You need someone who's willing to be with the troops, to get his hands dirty, to not be too fussy about procedure, but is willing to preach the word in season and out of season. There's a lot that you could do there with Friar Tuck as a churchman. But we're coming up close to time. Any final thoughts?
I think one thing that stands out about the Disney version is just the songs. They walk around singing the songs all the time. It's just a great soundtrack. So if nothing else, watch the movie with your kids, but also listen to the songs sometimes together. I mean, if you've watched it enough, then they'll know the songs. That's how you know that you've watched it enough and you're doing it right. If they can sing the songs, you're in good shape. Levi, I can't tell you how many times a week he says, hey, could you whistle the Robin Hood song? And then I'll start whistling part of it. And he'll say, could you start from the beginning? And by that, he means he wants me to do the first song when they're walking in the woods. And then he also wants me to transition to the archery tournament song, which is great.
Yeah. Kelsey and I sing, but not in Nottingham, to each other a couple of times a month, I'd say. Yeah. Sometimes the ups outnumber the downs.
Yeah.
Not in Nottingham. Yeah.
That's a good one. I'll have to bring that back next time there's an appropriate occasion. That's clever.
Well, what book recommendation do you have for us today, sir?
Today, fittingly, I think, I have The Dangerous Book for Boys by Con Iguldin. So this book, if you don't know, is not a story, so to speak, although it has stories in it. It's kind of an everything book. It's almost like a tiny encyclopedia for little boys. And I would say at any age, you should give this book to your boys. And so it's got all kinds of things. You know, it's got experiments that you can do with things laying around the house, making a battery out of quarters and aluminum foil and paper clips and things like that, how to wire a rudimentary circuit off of that battery. It's got famous battles and kind of maps that break down where the troops moved and what were the stakes and who were the players and why is this battle remembered. each of these things is maybe two or three pages long. You know, it's one of those books that kind of just jumps from thing to thing. Oh, let's see. It's got all kinds of survival skills and things about fishing or hunting or finding north without a compass. You know, all sorts of really, really wonderful, inspirational things that will get your boys hands-on, not just reading and thinking about these things, but they will be eager to try it. You know, how to make a shelter or in the woods or whatever it is. They'll want to go and take this idea and do something with it and gain that oh so important skill for young boys of agency in the world around them. They will learn how to affect the world around them based on all kinds of different examples of things from this book. So The Dangerous Book for Boys by Con Iguldin. I loved it as a boy. I wholeheartedly recommend it to anyone.
Yeah, that's a great one. For some reason in my upbringing, it was eclipsed by the American Boys Handybook. I don't know if you had that one, but that was the one for me. And then I came to The Dangerous Book for Boys when I was older, and it didn't pack the same punch. But no, Dangerous Book for Boys is gold. My recommendation this week is a middle grade fiction book called By the Great Horn Spoon, which I read to the kids maybe 6 months ago. It's by Sid Fleischman, who's written a whole bunch of other stories, including The Whipping Boy, which I think won a Newbery. He wrote the McBroom's Wonderful 1 Acre Farm stories, which are also great. But By the Great Horn Spoon is a story of a young boy in Boston whose parents die and leave them destitute. And so he decides, as is reasonable, run away from home to California to go strike it rich, and so that he can come home and bring gold back, and save the family fortunes for his younger sisters. But he's accompanied by his faithful butler, Praiseworthy, and the two of them then have wonderful adventures both on the boat to California and while there. And it's a coming of age story. It's a story of, you know, Praiseworthy becoming spoiler alert, becoming a father to the boy. And it's a story about masculinity in wild and woolly circumstances. It's just great. Can't recommend it highly enough. By the Great Horn Spoon, Sid Fleischman.
That's great. And that's all the time we have for today. So if you've enjoyed the show, thank you for joining us. And if you're interested in what we're writing about, you can see a link to our Substack in the show notes below. We want to say thank you to Shane Caver, who has provided the theme music for the show.
Thanks, Shane.
And if you would like to follow his music, you can also find a link to his Spotify account below. With that, we hope that you've been blessed and edified by the show.
Don't be hasty.
Where was I going?
Dang it.
Gonna be a lot of editing in this episode. It's okay.